Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Cal Mabry is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll have the final show in a kind of an informal series that we have been doing over the past few weeks, trying to talk about international issues and how they play into the presidential campaign. We've talked a little bit about global food issues. We've talked about America and its relations with Latin America and with Africa. We've talked about the Middle East. We will round things out here talking, I'm sure, a little bit at least about relations between the United States and Russia, but also in a broader sense, I think we'd like to try to talk a little bit about the place of America in the world today and how we think about that and perhaps how we've thought about that in the years since the end of the Cold War. Certainly, with the end of the Cold War, it seemed, for a moment at least, that America stood alone as the last remaining superpower. And certainly today, America remains a dominant military power. But in other ways, it's very clear that our influence around the world has been diminished. Well, we'll be talking this morning with the two guests, both of them here from the University of Illinois, Derek Frazier. He is assistant professor of political science, and also Richard Tempest. He is associate professor of Slavic languages here at the U of I. He's also director of the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center. He's been here on the program before to talk a little bit about those kinds of issues, that is, Russia and the United States. Derek Frazier, this is his first time. Glad to have you here. We appreciate both of you being here. And, of course, as we talk, questions from listeners are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks both of you very much for being here.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
Thanks.
Perhaps to begin, I would give both of you the opportunity to talk in a general sense, as large a frame as you want, about sort of the nature of American power in the world today, and particularly maybe reflecting on that notion that we had for all too brief a time about it being a unipolar world with the Soviet Union gone, and now being something different, and it's difficult to say what. How did you start us off?
Unipolarity. That's certainly something that I think that we sort of celebrated at the end of the Cold War. And as you said, it was sort of short-lived in many respects. And I think it became fairly apparent on September 11th that unipolarity doesn't mean very much. What the United States has had trouble sort of effectively doing since the end of the Cold War is finding a sort of an adversary, if you will, someone that sort of we could direct our energies against. There's this sense that since the demise of the Soviet Union that the United States had, to put it in sort of President Bush's terms, a political capital, so to speak, where we were the only superpower left. We dominated and still do the international system both militarily and economically. And consequently, we were expecting sort of other countries to sort of look toward the United States for continuous leadership in the post-Cold War period. What we've started to find now is that countries aren't so wild about the way that we're running things, if you will. There's starting to be some pockets of resistance in terms of what we presume to be our right or our sort of mandate with respect to unipolarity and what other countries see as that that same set of responsibilities. And I think there's starting to be conflicts of interest with respect to those.
Mm. Well, it seems to me when we talk about this that we put this title on the program, Is the United States Power in Decline? Which I'm sure in some quarters would start fairly heated debate. And I guess some people would say, well, you know, the United States is still the world's leading military power and is still a significant economic power and is still a significant cultural power. So in a sense, the United States still dominates the world in many ways. So one wonders, though, what exactly has changed. If those things all are still true, then where does this sense of decline come from?
I would say the relativity in terms of the amount of power that the U.S. has relative to other countries, that gap is starting to shrink. So the U.S. certainly dominates still economically if you look at the gross domestic product of the United States compared to – we talk about China, but the U.S. still dominates economically vis-a-vis China in terms of its gross domestic product. Militarily, the United States spends more on its defense than the next 10 countries combined. So that dominance is still there. What's happening, however, is that you're seeing the rise of countries like China, like Russia, both economically and militarily. And that gap, therefore, is closing. So it may not be necessarily a decline in terms of global power for the United States. It's just that everyone's sort of catching up. So the United States isn't necessarily losing power. Others are gaining power. Mm-hmm. And I guess in some respects, that is a loss of power, but slightly different interpretation.
Yesterday on the program, we actually spent a little bit of time talking about Russia and its foreign policy, particularly as it was directed to the, to its immediate neighbors. And we had on a fellow here who was here at the University of Illinois for quite a long time,
Roger Cannon,
who I hadn't seen and talked to in a long time, and it was nice to have him. He was here visiting and nice to have him back. So we were talking a little bit about that, and sort of the point that we started from was his talking about how when the Soviet Union came apart and there was no Soviet Union anymore, that the United States and Europe and probably, you know, a lot of people said, well, Russia doesn't matter anymore. We don't have to deal with Russia. If our interests conflict with theirs, then we're just going to say, well, too bad, Russia. We're after all the lone superpower. And certainly people in Russia didn't think that. They were intent on Russia continuing to be an important player on the world stage. And certainly Russia has significant power. Where do you think we are now with the relationship between the United States and Russia? And it seems that it's something that just isn't really terribly discussed. It certainly hasn't particularly come up with as a campaign issue this time around.
That is true. Russia has not figured prominently in the discourse of the presidential campaign. I would say that there was a element, if you like, of intoxication, not only in the United States, but perhaps around the Western world at least, with the collapse of the communist bloc, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the disintegration of the Soviet Union. There was a sense of a world historical victory. And Russia in the 1990s went through a very painful, very traumatic series of economic and political changes, which made it, to some extent, a more introverted, a more, if you like, self-centered state. But once, for a variety of reasons, the economy started improving, a new, younger leader, Vladimir Putin, came to power, and there was a concatenation of favorable factors that improved conditions in Russia, economic, certainly, and there was a great deal of much more stability, one of Putin's some mooted achievements he likes to talk about, the stability he's brought to Russia. Once these things happened, interesting enough, these traumas, these resentments that the ruling elites in Russia felt, and very many people, ordinary people felt, began to find an expression, and actually it became possible for Russia to act on them. I always tell my students that we should not underestimate the role of emotion, the role of sort of non-rational, if you like, factors in political decisions. And to some extent, perhaps not to a defining extent, but to some extent, Russia's behavior on the international stage has to do with a desire to effect a kind of payback to a what they saw as a triumphalist United States. Mm-hmm. And perhaps I might add here that Vladimir Putin enunciated in February 2007 at a security conference in Munich, which was also attended by John McCain, the new foreign policy doctrine of the Russian Federation, in which he mentioned the desirability for his wish for a multipolar world. He talked about the way in which NATO expansion was affecting Russian interests as he saw them. This address, which was delivered in a rather confident, even perhaps aggressive manner, marked the formal statement of this new Russian doctrine of not a superpower. They don't view themselves, they don't call themselves a superpower, but a great power in, if you like, the 19th century sense, with their own sphere of influence, their own legitimate security and economic concerns along the periphery of the borders, and their desire, or if you like, their willingness to compete with the United States, with other Western powers in these areas, and sometimes, as recently happened in the case of Venezuela, even sort of poking a finger into Uncle Sam's eye and sending naval vessels or planes to the South American continent.
We have a caller here, and let me just very quickly introduce again our guests. The last person you heard, that's Richard Tempest. He is he is an associate professor of Slavic languages here at the U of I. He is also director of the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center. Also here in the studio is Derek Fraser. He is assistant professor of political science, and we're talking about the nature of American power today. Questions, welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here, someone in Batavia, and they're on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Good subject. I feel in these days and times that the Americans are, our American government is looked on badly from other countries. The war started it, I think. But I also believe that our government officials have not tried to, they favor one group over another group, and until it goes bad, and then they kind of dump them. And I don't know. The outlook, from what I understand, in Europe is not good about us, so they don't really trust us anymore, because just solely from the Iraq war. And I can't blame them. We're sitting here sleeping at the wheel, so to speak, and Russia has been building, rebuilding their military powers. And what really frightens me is this isn't getting reported on by neither candidate or by the news media. And Russia has proved that they're not going to stop. A good case is Chechnya. So I'm kind of curious to see what you guys say, and if you think I'm just an extremist, paranoid person. Thank you.
All right. Well, we'll go back. Both of you can take a shot at it, but maybe I'll go back to Richard Tempest. And what – I guess the question is, does Russia continue to pose a security challenge to the United States, and what would be the nature of that? If the answer is yes, what would be the nature of that challenge?
A challenge, yes. I wouldn't necessarily say a threat, but a challenge. I think part of the problem is that because of developments in recent years, Russia has found itself pretty much outside the security architecture that exists at the moment. NATO, for instance, has expanded into Eastern Europe, into the former states, members of the Warsaw Pact. And one could even argue that NATO, which was founded to counterbalance a perceived Soviet threat during the Cold War, found its new mission in its continual enlargement. So it's not very clear what NATO is for. That, I don't think, has been perhaps explained to the electorates in the Western countries. So my feeling is that certainly Russia will never want to join NATO, but perhaps some new security arrangement could be devised which would bring Russia in, because leaving Russia outside on the margins, a resentful Russia, a Russia that feels to some extent unjustly treated by the other great powers, especially by the United States, is just a recipe for trouble.
I would sort of echo some of those comments and say that for the caller to maybe put it in a different perspective, I think that one of the things that Americans have difficulty doing particularly our politicians, is thinking, and this is where I think some of the sort of resentment or the hostility and the challenges come from, is that we sort of perceive a sort of resurgent Russia and a very aggressive Russia. And I think to some extent that's the case. If you look at what happened in Georgia, certainly the Russians sort of responded to the Georgian provocations with overwhelming force and certainly more than what was necessary. But if you look at it from the Russian perspective for a moment and sort of envision, what, if you will, that you have the United States who's sort of continuously expanded NATO since the end of the Cold War without, as Richard said, without any sort of defined purpose. You know, if you're Russia, you have to sort of identify that as a threat. Certainly, it would seem that given an absence of another identity, that NATO is expanding and expanding for with respect to concerns about Russia. Once NATO expands to the point that it actually touches upon Russia's near abroad, then this becomes problematic for Russia, who historically has had to deal with conflict coming from that direction. For the smaller countries on Russia's near abroad, it certainly makes sense to join NATO, given that they have fears about a resurgent Russia. So I think that if you sort of look at it from both perspectives, you see sort of an action reaction, and that if you know from whatever perspective you take, certainly appears to be justified. So I would sort of caution the caller to think about Russian policy in context to American policy as well, as opposed to an isolated set of events. Mm.
The caller also made reference to the way perhaps people around the world and in Europe and elsewhere think about the United States. What do you think it would take to get people to think more favorably about the United States? Obviously, that's not something that's going to happen really right away. I'm sure there will be a change of administration, and people, one would hope, would reserve judgment, would wait and see what happened, see what the new policies were like. So maybe it might take a while for that to change if it was going to change. What do you actually see potential for that to change?
Yes, there is potential. Whoever becomes president will represent a new face, whether it's Senator McCain or Senator Obama. And both of these men have aspects to their political personas that could be appealing. I have to caution, though, our listeners that historically the most powerful country in the world, whether it was the Roman Empire, or, I don't know, the Spanish Empire in the 16th century, were unpopular, broadly speaking, because they were the most powerful country. And you do tend to cause hostility and resentment just by your very size and your very ability to act sometimes unilaterally. I would also add that while there are a number of countries in Western Europe, of course, in the developing world, in South America, as we know, that have a beef with the United States, there are also countries, in Eastern Europe in particular, where the United States is very popular, both among the ruling elites, but perhaps more interestingly and significantly among the ordinary voters. I mean, Poland is one such country. Bulgaria is another such country. And one has to bear in mind that there are all kinds of historical cultural reasons why a given country's great power's reputation is strengthened or weakened in the eyes of the man in the street.
Yeah. We have another caller. Let's talk with him in Effingham, line number two. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for the bit of an overview there in Spanish. I'm thinking that it goes far beyond that, and we have to take history back to 10,000 years and the evolution of that, and how one paradigm is overwhelmed by the next, and that being the practice up until now. The U.S. will remain the world's only superpower because of its atomic weapons and its willingness to use them. Yes, there are other people that have them. There are the recent gift of atomic technology to India as a stall against China. But what it all boils down to me, for me, is the fact that capitalism, just like all the other paradigms that preceded it, has decayed away. And now it's obvious around the world that the very few who get to participate in that process, now here at home with the recent fall of the Wall Street and all that shakeout through, we're the American population at the bottom now will become the same as the third world, and maybe the not the fourth, but mainly the third world, and how that's going to play out. You know, the thing that I see are some dark and tenuous times ahead of us, both as a population here and abroad, and how we're going to respond to that. You know, when you get hard times, you get revolutionary thinking. And that is what I think I see coming. Hopefully, it can be steered and evolved by disinterested people who see the future. I'll hang on and see if you have any response to those statements or questions about how that's going to play out.
Well, I'm certainly interested in your thoughts about the current economic crisis that's going on not only in the United States but everywhere, because it's a globalized economy, and what sort of political fallout that there might be from that, particularly outside of the United States.
Well, one of the things I think is interesting, I think this demonstrates the amount of power that the U.S. still has. You know, if the United States economy falls, and as we've seen over the last month, that when the stocks drop, the stock market suffers a collapse, that there's a very large ripple effect. And I think the United States has put itself in a position that it's so important to the system that if it were to fall, everyone else is going to fall along with it. So I think if the caller's concerned about sort of U.S. declining with everyone else remaining the same, that's unlikely to happen. One of the things that's interesting, the caller mentioned sort of revolutionary ideas. One of the things that the United States has sort of focused upon in terms of the post-Cold War period is promoting democracy. And one of the potential challenges, and this may sort of this may arise out of the fact of thinking about the debt crisis in a sort of slightly different way, is that democracy in and of itself may be somewhat more precarious than we think. Meaning that in terms of alternative systems, perhaps Russia, China represent another sort of path that that could be potentially dangerous for the United States and Western Europe, and having sort of an authoritarian capitalist type of system where the state has much more control over the system but still sort of operates on these sort of free market principles to some extent. And I think if the caller's concerned about sort of a change in the international system, that's one of the potential possibilities that people have talked about, that the China and Russia could represent different models of development. And that may be something that is worth further discussion. As far as the debt crisis itself, I certainly think, again, it sort of serves as a large example of just how important America is to the international system. Mm.
And I would add to what Derek so eloquently said, that in a sense we're all capitalists now, and Russia is an essentially capitalist economy with, of course, certain quirks, which to some extent are culturally based. But there is a growing middle class in Russia, and it's still a fairly small proportion of the population. I think it's something like 10%. On the other hand, China, which clearly is a capitalist economy, has a middle class which is actually larger than the American middle class in numerical terms, possibly not in overall standard of living, but certainly you have the presence in both these very important players in the world, elements in the population who have a stake in a particular political system. And also if you look at the way in which the world has generally been developing in the last 15, 20 years. The sort of capitalist path is one that seems to have been the preferred method. And empirically speaking, the successes in among the developing emerging economies, Brazil, India, China, and Russia, have come, many people would say, because they are following, generally speaking, kind of Western-style capitalistic path of development.
Yeah. We're at our midpoint here. I want to thank the caller and invite others. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guests this morning, Richard Tempest and Derek Frazier. Richard Tempest is director of the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center at the U of I. He's also associate professor of Slavic languages. And Derek Frazier is assistant professor of political science. And this is the sort of the last and wrapping up program in a little series that we've been doing, looking at international issues and the American presidential race. And again, people who are listening are certainly welcome. I want to maybe pick up on another point that the caller glancingly made and in referring to American military power. And I think that some people would say that we have erred because we have put ourselves in the position where the main kind of power we have to exercise is military power. It's hard. What is going to be called hard power as opposed to soft power? And I think soft power is the term. I'm not sure when that was coined, but it's something that I sort of feel like I have been maybe hearing only within the last, I don't know, 10 years or something like that. And making the point that there are different kinds of power and that other nations actually have been much better at using their soft power, and China is one of them, particularly in the developing world, has been doing this. The other countries have been actually understood that perhaps you can do more using that kind of power than you can by reminding everybody that you're the biggest guy in the block and you have the biggest army. Do you think that in fact that is the case? Do you think that the United States has perhaps missed some opportunity because we have not appreciated just how what you can do with soft power?
I don't know if I would go so far to say that. I think that U.S. soft power plays a prominent role. I think the problem is it's not sort of the sexy sort of outstanding role. When the U.S. uses its military power and its military capability, it stands at the fore. There's oftentimes lives at stake. It's going to capture the headlines. Whereas the soft power, the day-to-day things that the U.S. does in terms of its diplomatic capability, I think is somewhat less focused upon. That being said, I think certainly over the last 8 years, given our military operations in Afghanistan and Iraq, that our soft power has dwindled. And I think from the perspective of other countries, whether it be the developing world or Western Europe, that there has been this sort of question about why the U.S. isn't using the soft power the way it has in the past. This idea of soft power really sort of caught hold during the 1970s when there was particularly during the oil crisis, when there's a question of how the U.S. could sort of utilize its soft power to get countries to sort of buy into the system, the international economic system that had sort of been in operation, but through the 70s sort of there were obviously problems with it. So getting other countries to buy in. So I think that the U.S. certainly, again, has declined in its soft power capabilities. Again, given it spends so much more on its military capability, you would expect that it's going to use it. And that sort of calls in the question for the next president, perhaps the need to invest more in soft power capabilities, both in terms of diplomacy, which the State Department, the funds that the State Department gets pales in comparison to the Defense Department, and then other avenues of soft power, again, the sort of cultural ideas, the foreign aid. We donate a very small percentage of our GDP, less than 1%, less than 0.1%, I believe, somewhere in there, to foreign aid, which is not what the U.S. should do if it wants to increase its soft power. And given the nature of the threats that the U.S. faces today and that we'll probably face in the future, military power isn't going to be the solution that we can sort of continuously utilize. And I think the next president will certainly have to at some point come to that conclusion and have to sort of reinvest, redivert our attention from hard power to soft power.
I agree with everything Derek said. I would add that in the past there have been periods in American foreign policy when soft power was very much at the forefront of America's efforts to engage with the world. And I'm reminded of Jimmy Carter, a president whose tenure in office was not perhaps the most successful, but who was in a sense a visionary because his emphasis on human rights, desire to compete with the then Soviet Union in the arena of human rights, democracy, free speech, had a tremendous appeal, actually, across Eastern Europe. And in fact, it was around 1979, 1980, when some of the processes began that led to the eventual unraveling of the old Soviet Union, the Soviet bloc. Also, I might add here that a culture is something that sometimes Americans are not quite aware is has a tremendous appeal, because music, lifestyles, movies, the internet, all these media are elements in America's kind of presence in the world, and even people who are very hostile or feel they're hostile to the United States wear blue jeans, listen to heavy metal or rap in their own languages, perhaps, but nevertheless, these are genres that were invented in the United States. And so there is a element of, there is a connection, if you like, that perhaps can be developed further. It requires imagination, and sometimes the people who are in charge of foreign policy, these are professional people, and sometimes they tend to be severely middle-aged and set in their ways and don't think in these terms.
I want to sort of comment on the soft power thing, because I think it's something that I think a lot of people miss out on. The soft power doesn't necessarily have its own set of consequences. I mean, it has its own set of consequences as well. As a good example, China uses its soft power and has been using this in Africa in terms of its economic assistance and providing loans and aid to countries in Africa, but doing it without conditionality. And Richard touched upon an important point that the U.S., when it does sort of apply soft power, it typically likes to make sure that that soft power is utilized and it's going to be sort of consistent with what its overall grand strategy might be. So in the case of Africa, for example, providing economic aid and assistance, which certainly would be one facet of soft power, comes with some strings attached. And so that competition soft power between the U.S. and China, for example, may be a little bit easier for China because of less conditionality. It certainly stands out in the economic case, but in other cases it may be the same as well. So I think we shouldn't sort of assume soft power is sort of naturally a benign type of activity. It does require some sacrifice. It's just typically not as much as the hard power approach.
We have several callers, and we're now into about our last 15 minutes, so we'll try to certainly get these three in, and others we'll try to. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. First in line is Urbana in line one.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to go back and pick up on a topic you brought up a while back, that the United States has promoted democracy since the Second World War. And I would submit this is open to question, that it's probably true, or at least possibly true, in the case of the Truman administration and maybe Carter. But for the most part, what has been promoted is westward-leaning governments and capitalism, and in particular in the last 30 years, a form of laissez-faire capitalism. And that in particular, what's interesting is that American politicians have tended to conflate capitalism and democracy as though they were a single entity. And that clearly is not true. There have been democracies in Europe, the Scandinavian countries, which were socialist, but certainly very democratic. And we see today that there are capitalist economies which are existing in the near complete absence of a democratic political system. China, Vietnam, Russia, among others. And some might argue the United States, although I wouldn't quite go along with that. But I wish you would take up this dichotomy and how it has been successful on the part of American politicians to conflate what I think are actually quite separate matters.
All right. Go ahead.
I think the caller is absolutely correct. I think the United States, there certainly is a difference between democracy and capitalism. The United States, the model that's worked for the United States has been democratic capitalism, and I think that would historically has desire to see that in other countries. The problem is in terms of promotion, whether or not it's been able to do that consistently. I think the caller's correct to pick up on the fact that the United States has not done that consistently. When other national interests have gotten in the way, the United States has made sure that countries are more Western, pro-Western capitalists, more so than concerns about democracy. In fact, I'd go farther and say that democracy promotion has been one of those things that when it's easy for the United States to do, and with the present Iraq and Afghanistan aside, the United States has been much more willing to do that than when it's been more difficult and challenging to other national interests. And you're right, there are perhaps other alternative models that don't take into account democracy but include capitalism. I also think we should sort of point out that, you know, in the context of Scandinavia, for example, that one shouldn't confuse socialism as sort of an sort of overarching model. There's, you know, different sort of components of that, both economically and socially. So certainly the social element for the Scandinavian countries is sort of more socialist in nature, but they are by no means socialist in terms of their lack of participation in the capitalist economy.
Do you want to add anything, Richard?
Yes, I'd like to add something to this. I think sometimes it's useful to change the terms of the conversation. Let's take China and Russia. To take China first. Here's a country which is clearly and, in fact, self-confessedly, as it were, non-democratic. It's an authoritarian regime, perhaps even totalitarian, one could argue. But if you look at the context, the Chinese history, and which is a very long history, of course, I think one could say that China is now at its most prosperous in 2,000 years. It's got perhaps the most competent government it's had in 2,000 years. And the sum of human happiness, if you like, which is unquantifiable, but which one could say is a useful measure for evaluating a particular culture, particular society. The sum of human happiness there has risen compared with, let's say, the Cultural Revolution or the period in the 1930s, 20th century when China was the a prey to Western colonial powers, or the period of the Opium Wars. And the same applies to Russia. I mean, Russia is a country which has done some, to put it very politely, questionable things in Georgia and Chechnya and elsewhere. Yet if you take standards of living, if you take, at least until recently, until the collapse of the Russian stock market, which fell 70%, has fallen 70% since May. But if you take the Putin years, at least, you can certainly, this has been the most prosperous time in the 20th century for Russia. And they've had the best economic times. And so if you think in terms of, you know, the possibility of self-realization, people having the opportunity to send their kids to college, to follow a particular profession, to travel freely, quality of life. For many people, not all people, things have been looking up. It doesn't mean to say that one shouldn't wish for and indeed work for democratic change, because I think, it's my personal conviction, that democracy is the best way for people to realize themselves fully. But one should, I think, remember that there is this perspective of relative change, relative to what had existed before.
Well, again, I want to thank the caller. I hope you won't mind if I go on to the others here. The next would be Champagne in line number two. Hello.
Yeah, what's your reaction to the placement of missiles that don't work in Eastern Europe? And what do you think is going to happen in that regard? And I'll go off and let you talk about it.
Certainly, this has been one of the big points of contention between Russia and the United States recently.
Right. I would say that these missiles have become a point of contention far beyond their military significance, or even their usefulness as a possible instrument of protection against Iranian, it's a putative Iranian attempt to attack Western Europe and the United States. Russia sees them as one more example of American unilateralism. They clearly understand that these missiles don't represent a particularly grave threat to Russian national security, but at the same time, it's in the backyard, and it's like a poke in the eye. And the United States, for its part, feels that now that it's insisted and spent a great deal of diplomatic capital in Poland, the Czech Republic, to get these missiles in place, it cannot retreat. I would say that with the new administration, whether Republican or Democrat, there is the opportunity to use these missiles as a bargaining chip. If they matter so much to the Russians, perhaps the Russians will be willing to pay something diplomatically to get them removed.
Yeah, in some ways I see this analogous to the Cuban Missile Crisis, obviously not to the same sort of intensity, but the same sort of parallels there with placement of missiles that really are not terribly important to the strategy, security strategy of either side. But they represent a signal, and I think they make a signal both, you know, if the Russians don't do anything about it, then it sends a signal to their population that that the United States is able to infringe upon what's been their typical sphere of influence. The United States, by the same token, as Richard pointed out, there's political capital there that makes it difficult for at least this administration to remove, but the next administration may have that opportunity.
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guests are Derek Frazier. He is Assistant Professor of Political Science, and Richard Tempest. He is Associate Professor of Slavic Languages and also Director of the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center, both of them here at the U of I, talking with us in this part of Focus 580 about American power today. And questions are welcome. We have someone else here just ready to go. Let me give you the numbers again. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The next caller is Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
Yes, hello. I was listening earlier the referral to whether using soft power or hard power as a, in a sense and why it's done and whether it would be used more soft power in the future or not. But if you really think about the huge military complex that the U.S. has now, and even both major presidential candidates are now planning to expand this, so how is there any expectation that we'd move away from using this military you got to use it for something, right? So it's a huge financial gain for all these companies as well. So I don't see any expectation that there will be more favor for soft power instead of this hard power, because otherwise how do you justify all this money that's diverted to the military complex?
That's a great question. I think that one of the things that has been talked about over the last several years is redefining the role of the U.S. military. So you're right. You spend all this money in the military. You're going to use it. It's going to be a central component of your foreign policy, one would imagine. So one way of dealing with that is sort of redefine things. So, for example, in Africa, one of the things that with the United States is a new African command, and one of the sort of primary tasks for the African command is to try to integrate better with the State Department apparatus that exists in Africa so that the U.S. military can provide, you know, logistical support. It has the equipment and the manpower to actually do some of the things that the State Department can't do. So if you can perhaps coordinate between the sort of Defense Department and the State Department, then perhaps you can utilize the military even for soft power missions and soft power roles, you know, building schools, building roads. Now, there's a big debate on whether we want the U.S. military to be doing that or not, whether they should focus their attention on training for the next set of conflicts and adversaries. But that is certainly an open debate and one that I think needs to be had, because we do have such a large resource in the military, and you can't have them sitting around doing nothing. Yeah. And you certainly don't want to go around provoking conflict to get them to do something.
And I might add to that that the military is, of course, famously traditionally hierarchical, and it's a professional set of contains a professional set of professional institutions. It has its own way of doing things. But even within such hierarchies and institutions, there are original thinkers. There are people who think outside the box, as it were. And one example of that would be a general who was recently in the news, General Petraeus, who. Has read Dostoevsky, who has intellectual interests, who has imagination. And while one might not be able to rely upon the military itself to always offer new solutions, and perhaps that's not their place. One would hope that the political leadership, new political leadership, whether Republican or Democrat, would select the more original thinkers, flexible thinkers, people who are not hung up on building multi-billion-dollar aircraft carriers, which, since they don't have little feet or little propellers and can't fly over land, are sometimes not particularly useful resolving conflicts that take place, let's say, in the middle of a landmass, but look really good on the TV screen and give lots of people lots of jobs and lots of contracts. So it's a question, as it always is in the political sphere, of getting new ideas and fresh perspectives. And that's one of the strengths of the democratic process, that you do get once in a while the opportunity to have an infusion of new thinking, new blood, and reforms can be made.
Yeah. I'm very interested in this whole discussion about the possibility of a new mission for the military. Just in the sense that it seems a difficult challenge. The military, basically their mission and what they're trained to do is blow stuff up. And now what we're doing is we're saying, well, maybe we could make them into humanitarian aid workers. And it seems, not that that's impossible, but that's a completely different orientation of purpose and mission.
Sure. I don't want to make it sort of put it out there that we're talking about sort of wholesale change to the military mission. But I think, as a great example, we have the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers that's been doing a great job in Iraq in terms of rebuilding. So one wonders whether that type of approach can be utilized in conflict-torn areas in other parts of the world where the State Department really can only sort of interact with politicians and other diplomats. They don't have the material capabilities of actually doing those types of things. I think you have to limit, if you're going to engage in that type of strategy, you have to limit how much the military is going to be doing that. But one can argue, given that we spend, 10 times more than anyone else, that maybe we have a smaller component of the military that can be utilized for that purpose, not sort of making a wholesale change to the military entirely.
Yeah, I suppose another question would be, can people actually see the military? I mean, can people outside the United States actually see the military in that role? I guess I'm thinking about the fact that the United States has decided it has interest in Africa and it has created this AFRICOM, this Africa
right.
Command. The African Command is based in Germany, and it's in Germany because nobody in Africa wanted it. They couldn't find any host country to agree to be the host for the command. So it's in Europe. To me, that speaks volumes about how people think about the United States and the U.S. military.
No doubt. And I think it's going to take a lot of selling. I think it's going to take a lot of diplomacy to get that sort of change. But, that doesn't mean you shouldn't try it. I think that it may be worthwhile at least talking about it. And I think that you have to have our leaders sort of engage in this type of discussion and then move forward.
And here perhaps I might just add that in addition to the U.S. Corps of Engineers, which has done very useful work in Iraq and, of course, in the United States, there's, for example, the Coast Guard, which is another very flexible tool that's naval tool that engages with the civilian sector and has all kinds of involvements with domestic policy, foreign policy, of course, drug interdiction, but also other areas that the military traditionally we don't associate the military traditionally with.
Yeah. Real quick here, we'll try to get one more caller here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah. My question is about the democratic policy. I'm a physician with the Veteran Affairs, and I do see a lot of veterans coming in with damages and what they call collateral damages. Now, I see a difference in the democratic policy, which is by our leaders and the government, and then all of a sudden the people coming up and saying that they oppose certain policies, like, example, the war. If you're really thinking about democracy, there is a total disconnect between the policies which are actually followed by our leaders in Congress and in Senate compared to what the people really feel. See, I see that disconnect because the country goes to war, then you see a whole host of people against the war. Now, are we calling this democracy? That is my first question.
Well, pardon me for jumping in, but we're so short on time that we'll just have to deal with that question, and I'll have to give the guest a chance to respond.
I think democracy, we're representing the form of government, right? We're a republic, and we elect leaders to make decisions. Those leaders make decisions, and sometimes they're unfavorable with the public. But the public has a lack of information, and I think that's why we have to defer to leadership in some cases, and certainly have debates about these things. In the context of Iraq, I think there was very limited debate, and I think you have to put that on the shoulders of the public and members of Congress. You know, it's up to the public to have these types of debates to make sure that they're giving the appropriate information to their members of Congress, and they can make decisions about going to war or not. So I think, you know, there may be a disconnect, but I think that disconnect and a reasonable part of that disconnect has to fall on the shoulders of the public at large.
And I might just say that the call, in a sense, answers his own question, because he mentioned people who are demonstrating against the war in Iraq. The fact that they demonstrate, they make their voices heard, means that there is the possibility for democratic expression. I mean, I've traveled all over the world, and the thing that I really value about the United States is the opportunity, the possibility for people who dissent, who have different views, and who disagree with those who have power to make their voices heard.
Well, we're going to have to stop, and I really appreciate all the input from the people who are listening. I'm sure that many of these issues we will come back to on other days with other guests, but for the moment, simply because we're here at the end of the time, we're going to have to stop. With our thanks to our two guests, Derek Fraser, he is Assistant Professor of Political Science here at the U of I. Thank you.
Thank you.
And also Richard Tempest, he's Director of the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center. He's also Associate Professor of Slavic Languages, and thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.